This webcast is made possible in part by support from the listener members of the Classical Network, WWFM and WWFM.org. Thank you for your support. Cadenza, winner of the Deems Taylor Virgil Thompson Award for Broadcasting, is a production of the Classical Network. Funding for this program is made possible by the listener members of the Classical Network. I'm David Ozenberg, your host. Very happy today to be chatting with a composer about whom the Wall Street Journal has said of her music that it has long inhabited a terrain of its own, Julia Wolf. Born in Montgomeryville, just northwest of Philly, she drifted in and out of life paths, finally struck by music and its power. After studies at Michigan, she found her way east, met up with two young composers who were already fast friends, Michael Gordon and David Lang. She would marry Michael, and the three of them would found Bang on a Can with that famous 1987 marathon, still going not only in New York City, but globally with the Bang on the Can All-Stars, presenting critically acclaimed concerts, festivals, and recordings. She has always been drawn to the voice from her folk pop rock background, but also to strings, and after years of striving to keep pushing herself forward, in 2015, she won the Pulitzer Prize in Music for her work for choir and instrumentalists called Anthracite Fields. It was commissioned by the Mendelssohn Club of Philadelphia, then led by Alan Harler. It was the first commission she had received from her home state, and she turned her attention and talent to the coal mining industry and coal mining communities of Pennsylvania in this work. You're listening to some moments from the opening movement called Foundations, reciting names of miners who gave their lives in the mines. Here, just the ones with the first name John. This recorded performance is by the Choir of Trinity Wall Street and the Bang on the Can All-Stars, all under the direction of Julian Wachner, and we'll hear excerpts throughout the program from this disc. You can experience the work live in person this weekend, performed by the Westminster Choir and the Bang on the Can All-Stars, all under the direction of Joe Miller, in two performances at the Roebling Wireworks in Trenton, tomorrow and Saturday night at 8. I'll give further details at the end of our chat. Oh, she followed up her Pulitzer Prize-winning year by being named a MacArthur Fellow in 2016, one of the very few full-time composers ever to be so named. I caught up with my guest at Drew University in Madison, New Jersey, where she is serving as composer-in-residence.
Julia or Julie? This is the confusing part.
I know. My friends from childhood and wherever, they call me Julie. Okay. And my mom calls me Julie. Actually, sometimes my brothers call me Jules, but Julia is just my birth name, and so I was, born as. So I write my score, Julia Wolf. So some people, for example, Mark Stewart always calls me Julia, and David Costin always calls me Julie. So even in the band, it's a different name, but they're both good. I answer to all of the above.
We're here with composer Julia Wolf. We'll just go with that. We're here on the eve of another performance of Anthracite Fields with Westminster Choir College. So we're going to cover this, but put the Pulitzer aside, put the inspiration and the message aside. Are you surprised at all, given all the other stuff we just put aside, but are you surprised at the attention and the eagerness to present this piece that's being shown? Has it surprised you?
Definitely. But it's been an amazing experience as an artist to connect with people outside of the world I generally live in. So in other words, I'm usually interfacing with musicians, with presenters, and suddenly my world has really cracked open in terms of who is responding to the piece. I get a letter pretty much every week someone who's related to a coal miner. And that has been really beautiful, and I love that. It's just kind of who I am. Sometimes people think of a composer, and it's like the artiste, and I'm so not that. My roots are very, very earthy, what can I say, very grounded, in a lot of different ways. I'm from a small town in Pennsylvania. I grew up taking piano lessons, but being very connected to American folk music, played folk guitar, wrote songs in high school. So music to me, it's all equal, no matter what kind of power it has, whether it's classical or folk or pop. So the fact that I'm connecting with people who aren't necessarily, music lovers or art lovers. That's been really interesting and really special. Mm. And particularly because the subject, you know, the whole subject of the coal mining community is still present. There are people alive who were there. And I didn't think about that at the time, but now that I'm realizing that I've tapped into this community of people that were a part or connected to an industry that was huge. So really, literally, everywhere I go, if I go to California, somebody comes up to me afterwards and says, like, for example, in L.A., I thought, oh, it's not going to happen in L.A., but someone came up to me and said, my grandfather is on your list. And by list, the whole opening is a list of miners' names, just the Johns with one-syllable last names. And that was chilling. There's my grandfather on your list. So even when it's not as specific as that, just someone telling me that I came to this concert because I heard about it on the radio. My father was a coal miner. He died of black lung. This was a woman from Princeton who was a doctor who showed up to the concert, the premiere in Philadelphia, and starts telling me their stories. I'm like a listener now to coal mining tragedies. And I'm really into it. I never like, oh, yeah, and one more coal miner. I never feel that. I always am, wow, what was, you know, what happened? And what was your life like, or what was their life like? And this is nonstop, and it's been beautiful. And so anyway, that's a different issue than, you know, presenters, for example, being interested in the piece, but just the broad appeal or connection has been very moving.
It's a great testament to the power of music, even before they've heard it, just the idea that it could be set into an art form. You're from Montgomeryville, which is northwest of Philly. We have a lot of listeners in Philadelphia, in Bucks County. I live in Bucks County. So you tell a cute story just about the connection to this region, at least in Pennsylvania, that anybody who knows that area, and many of our listeners, really, there's this wonderful Route 309, which goes all the way up. If you go one way, you go into Philly. Probably spent a lot of time on South Street.
Yes, I did. And, as a teenager.
You go other ways, you go north. And eventually, after you pass the Lehigh Valley, which we have very many listeners in the Lehigh Valley, you'll get into Wilkes-Barre and Scranton. That's coal mining country. So, you know, your connection is the state and everything, but the inspiration to go there for your material and your sourcing of this, because also tied up into that, many people still have the notion the composer sits at a piano and the muse hits them and they start to write. You did tons of research for this piece.
Yeah.
So first search the genesis of it and then what you had to do till you felt you were ready to write it.
I really don't know why I went to look at that region. I mean, the initial impetus was I got a call from the Mendelssohn Club. They're a choir, very large choir based in Philadelphia.
Alan Harler
was the director at the time. He's amazing. The piece is dedicated to him. He's just a phenomenal musician and phenomenal person. Called me up. He does a lot of commissioning, which is pretty incredible for a choir of that size and that ilk. And he said, you know, I think he probably thought, oh, we'll ask Julie to write a 20-minute piece, something like that. So I called him back, and I was like, well, I really want to make a larger statement. I want an evening length. I want Bang at a Can All-Stars. I'm interested in this coal mining reason. Anyway, and he said yes. But the reason I thought about the coal mining region was because this commission was the first commission from my home state. By this point, you know, I've worked in a lot of cities. I've worked with a lot of ensembles all over the world. And I thought, this is so interesting. I've never worked in Pennsylvania. I mean, Bang in a Can has toured to Pennsylvania. Sure. We performed, but I've never had a commission from my home state. So I thought, oh, maybe I ought to take a look at that. And so just looking to the region, that came about because of wanting to say something about that.
Right.
The fact that I looked north instead of south, I don't know why I did that. I mean, I think Philadelphia is pretty well covered, you know, so I was curious about this region. I didn't know a lot about it. Literally, I would say 90% of the time I was on that highway, I would have turned south. I had one friend who lived north. My parents actually had friends in Wilkes-Barre, like some of their closest friends lived there. So I knew of it, and I used to take the train to school, and so the names would be shouted out, Hazleton, or wherever else. People were taking the train up in that direction, but I had no idea what that was or where that was. My grandmother grew up in Scranton. Was not a coal miner. I don't think anybody in the family was a coal miner. And the basic story is she got out as soon as she could. No insult meant to anyone living in Scranton, but it wasn't for her. She was like an older teenager and hightailed for Philadelphia, and that's why my family is there. But so I didn't really know a lot about it. I think I had a sense there's this coal mining region. I had never visited it. So some reason it just, some spark hit me and like caught my interest. And then I began this, you know, at least year-long process of reading books, going up and visiting, interviewing people, spending a lot of time at the Anthracite Heritage Museum, which is quite remarkable. It's a remarkable small museum that depicts everything about the life of that community from whenever it began, like the turn of the century to the 1960s or so. I mean, you can see the tools, you can see things from home life, you can see all the tragedies and all the documentation of the political events surrounding these various tragedies. And it was a great learning experience. It was like taking a fantastic history class that I never got to take.
So once you start to get all this information about the coal mining industry and those that toiled in it, young and old, I mean, the Breaker Boys and all that stuff in the second movement, how do you translate that then as a composer to say, now I have to start sifting and realize what's going to make up this piece? Because now you've filled your head with all this information which you didn't have.
Yeah.
So take us through that next creative step.
Well, I have a lot of notebooks, and I'm not organized. I didn't, which maybe is helpful in this situation, because I really went in completely open. I thought, I'm just going to listen. I'm not going to go in like, oh yeah, coal mining is really difficult. It's really, I knew it was going to be a dark subject, but I just wanted to listen and look. And then I just hoped that things would emerge that would say, oh, it's got to be in the piece. And that's what happened. I mean, I would scribble everything down in the notebook that seemed of interest, and then I would star things that look really juicy, like either heart-wrenching or fascinating, or, you know, whatever, for whatever reason, grabbed me. And then I would go back afterwards through all these notebooks, and I think I remember at one point I did this kind of color coding where I thought, okay, here are all these interesting texts or ideas or visual things that have to do with the Breaker Boys. So maybe that's like blue or something like that. And then here are all the things that have to do with the political struggle or the workers striking. Here are all the things that have to do with tragedies. And I would just kind of organize these various things that would emerge. And a lot emerged. And most of it's in there in one way or another. The rats did not get in there. But other than the rats, which were very interesting, I got to do a whole piece on the rats. Other than that, it's in there in one way or another, all the things that I was really struck by. I tried to also tell a story. It's not a narrative in this strict sense, or the story begins and then it ends. But I wanted to honor the people whose home this is. And as it turned out, and I didn't write it for them. If they hated it, that's also totally fine. It's not written so they would like it.
Right.
But they were very moved by it. And two of the people I interviewed came with their families to the premiere and were teary, you know. And the man I interviewed is a third generation miner. This man, John Soupy Jr. I know at some point in one of the interviews he said, I hope people remember this, you know, remember something about this life. And he came and he was, like I said, very teary afterwards. And he said, I'm so happy this is documented in this way. There are books written about it, but there's, you know, something about it that meant something to him. And that was incredible for me that we connected. You know, it wasn't just me kind of siphoning off information, that I really did try to understand something about the life. And he felt that. And then Barb, one of the women I interviewed, who was a daughter and a granddaughter of miners, she also felt that way. And she came just recently. We did the piece in central Pennsylvania, and she came to Bucknell, heard the performance there, had a chance to talk to the press about her life. She's actually been writing about her life her whole life, just writing everything about her experience of living in a patch town, having these grandparents nearby. It's sort of this multi-generational kind of life. And so, you know, again, interesting to connect with people who are very different, in some ways very similar to me, and they grew up in a similar kind of terrain, but very different paths, very different lives.
Another movement from my guest Julia Wolf's Pulitzer Prize-winning work, Anthracite Fields, the opening minutes from the movement Flowers, inspired by an interview the composer did with Barbara Powell, daughter and granddaughter of miners growing up in a patch town in Pennsylvania, bringing the community together through her gardening. Thank you.
a little bit about you. You mentioned growing up. You had a nice eclectic mix of music in the household. You went off to U of Michigan. I did a little dance, but then you take this music class, and it's kind of an epiphany semester. I wouldn't say a moment, but this is what really changed you and said, I can make a career of music instead of some other.
Oh, I don't know that I thought I could make a career.
Well,
at that
certainly,
point,
certainly lit a pilot light.
It would be. I would have been really practical if I had thought that, but I was like, whoa, music, it's amazing. I have to do this. And I think my parents were like, what's she taking in college? You know, because I come from a family more science-based, yeah. And it seemed like a real left turn to them. But I was not a practical young woman. I was, as it turned out really well, but I just had this crazy artistic passion to do this thing. And it was very, very exciting, very, very challenging. I thought, how do you write music? That just seems so foreign to me. I'm not from a family of musicians.
Right.
I would say it was definitely an epiphany, and it definitely spoke to me intellectually, emotionally, artistically, but I didn't think of it as having a direction.
But since we're here at Drew University, where you're composing residence, I mean, this woman who taught the class gave you a full spectrum of music, too. It wasn't just
yes.
a sliver. So you got to hear, your ears were opened up to many things which you hadn't heard before.
Definitely, yes. You know, but also like my freshman college roommate played me stuff I'd never heard before. So once again, you enter into college and you're interfacing with different people, and you know, that's when there were turntables. Not to date me, but that's when, you know, you throw something on the turntable and it just opens your mind, you know. So that's also, that's the great thing about college, I guess, that you get to suddenly share things with people that they love. But particularly that teacher, Jane Heyrich, was just an incredibly open-minded person. And
you make it out to the East Coast. You start to hang around with two guys, one you happen to marry, Michael Gordon, the other David Lang. They encourage you to go on. You go to Yale, start Martin Prezing. What was the initial bond between the three of you? What was that glue that sort of brought
those
the two of you in interest together?
Well, it started with Michael and David. They met when they were 16, although they didn't get along when they first met. They both went to the Aspen Music Festival as young composers, and they liked the same music. They were both getting very interested in music of Steve Reich and Philip Glass, but they had very different opinions about why they liked it, and apparently they didn't get along. I wasn't there to witness this, but the story is that they didn't get along. And then just by chance, they wound up in the same graduate program. Michael's, I think, came a year before David, and then David came, both at the Yale School of Music. And there they bonded because they were the guys sitting in the back, being renegades, you know, challenging the guest that was visiting. I think this was probably didn't make the life of their teacher so easily, because they would ask very challenging questions. And they bonded over this sort of questioning and rebellious spirit. Their friendship was very well established by the time I came along. And I just happened to be coming through New York City, and Michael's roommate at the time was a friend of ours, a photographer, and he said, oh, you should really meet Michael. First of all, you should come visit me. You always pass through New York, because I've come from Michigan through New York to Philadelphia, and you never visit me, so come visit me and meet this roommate who does all these things that you do. So that's how I met Michael. And at the time, I had had this wonderful open musical life in the residential college at the University of Michigan, but then I had started to go to the music school and take more kind of serious classes, history and theory and some lessons. And at that time, the lessons were much more severe and more oriented towards sort of modernist European aesthetic. And I was fascinated by it, and I was exposed to a lot of really interesting music, but it also was suffocating. And I met Michael, and I was describing my lessons, and he was like, you've got to get out of those lessons. So, you know, it was just wonderful connection. I felt like the world cracked open. This, the world is even bigger than I thought, because they were involved in lots of different kinds of musics and doing lots of different kinds of projects by that point. And I was like ecstatic to realize I could have comrades who were involved in really exciting things. So that was really a huge door opening. I just felt like so many things are possible. Suddenly I felt that after being in a more formal setting. I mean, I learned a lot from being in that formal setting, but it was an important moment.
So the three of you bond, obviously you and Michael are married, and you're sitting around sort of bemoaning the fact that the uptown new music scene at the time was cliquish and small, and the downtown music scene was cliquish and small, and there was no place for your guys' music or music of your strata for opportunities. So you mount this marathon in 1987, the Bang on the Can Marathon, which is now legendary, okay? I've never asked, I mean, I've had David as a guest, I have yet to have Michael as a guest, but I understand why the name came, but who actually coined it, let's do that name?
Well, I said it. This is the way things usually work. I kind of like unconsciously say something, and then I think it must have been David at the time. Oh, let's do that. I mean, we made a list of names. had all kinds of goofy names listed down, but we had used this phrase for a concert David had set up at the Cooper Hewitt, and I think I just said, oh, just put down it's a bunch of composers banging on cans. I just kind of said it off the cuff. And then when we started to make this list of names, we remembered that I'd said that, and David's, that's a title, you know, so... Did I say it thinking it was the name of a festival? No, but it's some goofy thing I said. And we really wanted to get rid of the formality, you know, sort of do away with a lot of the trappings that we thought were off-putting to your average, you know, curious person who was interested in arts or would go to new film and might go to new dance but might not cross the divide to going to new music.
Right.
So that name already just right away tells you it's not this official... intimidating organization for music specialists.
Right.
Doesn't sound like it.
Right.
At least.
The word new isn't in there. The
yes.
New music isn't
New
in
New
York
there. Isn't in there.
New York isn't in there. Any part of the city isn't in there. The Soho, the Chelsea, whatever.
Here are a few moments from my guest's work titled Four Marys, as performed by the Cassatt String Quartet, music by Julia Wolfe.
Your music, but also David and Michael, so there's this shared thing. I mean, if you look at your output, nowhere in yours or theirs you'll find any kind of traditional abstract. There's no symphonies, there's no sonatas, there's no even, you know, abstract number four, things like this. Even the grouping of your pieces, they're grouped more by the needs, like how many players it takes, and not by these subgenres, which are just sort of set in stone. That's a very conscious aesthetic to go towards. So your pieces have titles which mean something, which already create something in someone's head. Just talk about that a bit, because it's not unique, but to the three of you, it's unique, and your output, it's definitely, that's the way it is.
Right. I definitely think extra musically, and maybe even more than the other guy. David and Michael both do, and David in particular, many, many instances. But I have hardly a piece where I didn't think about something that inspired me that wasn't purely like notes and rhythms. So I always have a subject or an idea or an image that's brewing around. And part of that might be because my first creative work was with words. So creative writing in high school, you know, writing poetry, and in college getting into writing plays, and just very comfortable with language. Someone asked me in high school, what's your favorite subject? I'd say English. You know, so I just, you know, reading and writing was very enjoyable thing for me. And so when I came to music, it was challenging in a lot of different ways and really exciting, but it was always through this other lens, like what's the idea, what's the image. And so even early on, like the first string quartet I wrote, it's called Four Marys. It's the first time I'm writing for strings or exclusively for strings. And what string instrument do I play? Well, I had played the mountain dulcimer for a while, and so I'm thinking, what is it about the raw kind of crying sound of that? It's a pretty crude instrument in a way. And most people would say, oh, it's so intimidating to write for the string quartet. There's this long history of string quartet writing and the great composers. I really didn't think about that. I'm sure it's in my head somewhere, but I'm thinking about this folk instrument and translating the sound quality of that to these four string instruments. And Four Marys is the name of an old Scottish ballad that Jean Ritchie, who's the kind of queen of dulcimer playing, had played. And it's this dark Scottish tale of, you know, four Marys, but now there are three Marys. So for some reason, I'm drawn to these dark ballads, both British and American. So again, like the first thing is a story or an image, and that's true for most pieces that I've written.
Well, I'd say the pros and cons of that, I don't know if they're pros and cons. I mean, the pro is that it immediately, it's not just this abstract title of which, you know, anything can be poured into. The other side is you immediately set up, before hearing a note to the music, there's some kind of preconceived notion of what it might be, whether it's STEAM or Arsenal for Democracy or whatever it is. I mean, the title itself starts to brew images in somebody's head. And that's a risky aesthetic.
Yeah, it can be, but I like that dialogue. And I mean, I think that's true for a book. You know, when you go into a bookstore and you see the title, something's going to happen to you. You're going to be interacting with that title in some way. It could also be the cover with the image that someone's chosen. And that can be risky. Like, what is the cover of the book like? Well, it might not really relate to what the book is about. In my case, I tried to make it relate. I mean, sometimes you see with titles, there's a kind of very interesting, clever title, but does it really have to do with the music? To me, it's very ingrained in the music. So it was kind of the gestalt. So I was trying to figure out, what's the gestalt of this piece? What's its essence? And sometimes the titles come first, and sometimes they come at the end. But the idea is there from the beginning, and I try to always return back to what is that essence I'm dealing with. Even if it changes as I'm working on the piece, there's some roots that stay at the center of the piece.
And also, as people hear in your music and they go to the performance of Anthracite Fields, your influences are wide, and they're sort of unabashed. I mean, they just come in. I mean, there's part of this piece where just this rock number appears, and it's hard-driven rock music. It's not integrated in. It's not using the different instrumentation to sound like rock music. It's rock music for a few minutes. Yeah. It just is. The pop sort of nature of the Breaker Boys tune, that's also part of the aesthetic, is that you're not, like you said, all music is good music. It just appears, and you don't care at all about putting it in. So I'm telling you about yourself. I'm just saying just if you can comment on that, just to say that you're not going to say, well, this piece doesn't really... It's not going to make it veer off into kitsch or gimmicky or anything like that. You just use it.
Well, part of it is, I mean, there's a certain point, and it's funny because when you go to school, in a lot of senses, you need to unlearn a bunch of stuff. You learn a bunch of things, and I really value the things I learned and learned how to listen in a new way. But then you kind of have to unlearn it. You have to get your teachers off your shoulder.
Right.
And that took a little time. Even wonderful teachers, even like Martin Bresnik, who's a fantastic teacher, I can't have him on my shoulder. It has to be me on my shoulder. So there was definitely a certain point after getting out of graduate school where I was just like, oh, these guys have to go. And there were some, actually, obviously important women as well, but all of them out the window in terms of who's making the judgment call about the piece. And it's been interesting because I've noticed recently that my music is described as, I don't know if the word was eclectic, but using different styles. I don't think of it that way. And I finally, this last trip to Pennsylvania, I sat and I thought, how do I think about it? And I came up, for better or worse, because usually I let other people come up with how to talk about music, but it's kind of modal sonic. And that can cover a lot of territory. So it's not tonal, because the harmony and the notes don't really function in a traditional tonal way, but it's very modal, definitely, pretty much every piece. But then it's not simply modal, so it doesn't just sound like, let's say, early music or folk music that use all kinds of modes. But there's this kind of gritty, noisy quality. And those are the elements that, for me, stay fairly consistent. I mean, there's some pieces that may veer off of that a little bit. But for the most part, it's kind of modal sonic, for whatever it's worth. And, you know, like, for example, that moment you're referring to with the Breaker Boys, where I've got this heavy drum beat, I just thought, okay, these are adolescent boys. Obviously, I'm referring to a different time period. Thank goodness we do not have boys of that age working in the mines, at least in the U.S.
Right.
That's not true all over the world. There are kids working in mines of all different kinds, but not here. That's outlawed. But I wanted to take how I experience adolescent boy energy. Maybe there's the adolescent boy in me. And what is that? That's a drumbeat to me. And so I wanted to use that energy. And so I'm fusing these kind of old rhymes, some of them really directly from the region, with this hard drum beat that David Cosson just does so well. So I give myself that liberty. There's no problem with that. I love drum beats. I've danced to drum beats for my whole life. And so how do I do that in a way that is interesting to me? I can't obviously determine if it's interesting to somebody else, but to me, that's what I called upon for that energy. And so that's the liberty that I give myself. It doesn't matter where it's from. So I don't think of it as eclectic, but more, like I said, in this kind of way that I just draw different energies in from music.
Back to the recorded performance of my guest Julia Wolf's Pulitzer Prize-winning work, Anthracite Fields. This, the closing minutes from the second movement about the young lads who toiled in the mines called Breaker Boys.
Such a haphazard way that the Pulitzer, whoever runs this thing, really needs to shore up their communication system. You're the same way. Yeah. When this one in 2015, you're kind of like, what? You know?
Yeah.
I did what? And that's not an unusual story. So you can tell that, but then the post-Pulitzer. Again, not to go to pros and cons, but these composers said there's really good things about it, and there's really weird, sort of disturbing things about it.
Yeah.
Your experience.
Well, first I could tell you about finding out about it. It's interesting because I think it's more, no, I'm just speaking for myself, but it's more on the radar for journalists and writers.
Yeah.
I think that they know it's going to be posted on this day. It's so much a part of the world and part of the language. I mean, when you look at the list of who wins Pulitzer Prizes, it's mostly these amazing journalists. I was actually fascinated by these people who are doing this detective work and hunting and gathering and finding out and investigating, and it's incredible work. So they know that list is going to come out. I don't know whether it's on radio first. Probably these days it's online first.
Online.
And I don't know what day that is. I'm not thinking about what day that is. It's just not as much on my radar. So the way I found out was I was hanging out with Michael and David. Actually, sometimes we do meet in person and not just on the phone. David lives 10 minutes walking from where we live, and we were doing some banging a can stuff, and I was in the other room checking something for a minute. I walked over to my studio, and I got a phone call, and Kenny from Banging a Can, Kenny Savelson, who's our executive director, said, "Do you know what's going on?" I was like, "Oh, what?" You know, and the whole office, we were a very tight family collective, started screaming, "You won the Pulitzer Prize!" So I heard from my friends, which was really sweet, actually, and came back out to Michael and David with a sort of shell-shocked face. I think they probably thought, something wrong? And I was like, well, Kenny just told me I won the Pulitzer Prize. And so Michael pulled out a bottle of champagne, because we happened to have one, and we all drank and had fun. So it is funny the way they don't call you and tell you, but turned out fine. But okay, so then the question about whether it's positive or negative certainly has put wind in the sails of the piece. Definitely wonderful. Great to be recognized by your peers, because the panel is a combination of composers. Mostly composers wind up on the panel, and then usually a journalist and sometimes more musicologist, a writer of music. And that's a really wonderful feeling. And I remember the first time with Steel Hammer, it was a runner-up, and I was like, what? You know, I really didn't, wouldn't have anticipated that. These pieces are really earthy and kind of raw, and I don't think of them as fancy in any way, and I think my own association was Pulitzer Prize, very illustrious, you know. So I thought, wow, it's funny, got that far as a runner-up. And so when Anthracite Fields got it, I was just like, what? You know, so again, wonderful to have the support. You know, I think all artists who are on the inside recognize that it's incredible support and incredible encouragement, and it's also five people sitting in a room making a choice. And you put five different people, not to diminish it in any way or qualify it necessarily, but it is five very knowledgeable people and very smart and interesting people having a great discussion about music and coming up with an answer to this task they've been given. And if it's five different people, you're going to get a different best piece of that year, you know, and that's just the way it is. And I know that. I've been on that committee. I've been on twice now. And they've been great, and I loved the conversations we had. They were really, really fascinating. And you're going to get this kind of tension and dynamic and different opinions. And then somehow you figure it out in the process of 3 days. But that's what it is. And that's with everything anybody gets. And you can't ignore the fact that you've got, you know, Van Gogh, who like died in poverty, was not recognized, was penniless. And is incredible, genius. So, you know, not to say I'm taking it with a grain of salt, but it's great to get recognition while you're alive and not when you're dead. But great people are overlooked. Great people are acknowledged way later in life. Committees can be political at times. I think right now we're in a very open time, and I think just looking at the winners, let's say, of the past 10, 15 years, you can see that there's an openness to interesting ideas from a lot of different musical aesthetics, and that's great. No, I'm happy about that.
I agree. The winners of the past years is really very cool to see the wide range and ages and genders and all the rest of that stuff. I guess people saying, well, what was the cons? Well, it's not really a con, but I remember I was talking to David Lang about this. You know, it's that people who didn't give you the time of day beforehand, now you're the flavor of the month. That's not a con, but it does give you a little leeway to say, hold on a second, you know? I've been writing music for decades.
And that's good to understand that. I mean, it's always nice to be treated well. We talk about this. Sure. It's really great to get respect and get at least a decent hotel, you know, not a rat trap. And so there is a certain kind of care that's taken or attention that you get. It's very comfortable, but good to suddenly be aware, oh, this means something to people and respond to it. And again, I mean, I'm torn about prizes. Look, I went to this little program at the University of Michigan where there are no grades. And there's a reason why I went to this program where there are no grades, because I'm an idealist and I'm a renegade. And when we started Banging a Can, we had no bios. And there's a reason we had no bios in the program, because we thought, well, we want people to come and listen and decide if they like the piece, or not necessarily like or dislike, but what their thoughts are about the piece, and not think, oh, that piece won this award, or this composer has these accolades. Oh, that must be a very important piece. And that's what happens. And so we actually got rid of it. And then I think for the players, it first came back in because the performers felt that they actually get gigs based on some of the work they've done. So it first came back in. I'm torn about it still. I think it'd be great to get rid of them. I mean, I think program notes can be interesting if they illuminate something about the piece. Certainly with Anthracite Fields, it's really great to have the text in there and to have some of the background, because it is this kind of narrative. Other than that, though, I have a bio. People ask for the bio, I send it to them. But I also feel like it's nice to try to break some of that paradigm. And so I think we're all struggling with those issues.
Well, your bio will always say Pulitzer Prize winning composer. That's the way it is.
I could take it out.
You can take it out, but people put it back in. And we should have a footnote, because a year after that, 2016, you were a MacArthur Fellow. And that's, to me, even more impressive, because very few full-time composers have been MacArthur Fellows. And MacArthur's fellows, I know, are people who just, you know, they're kind of like creative tornadoes. I mean, they just keep going and going. And you have always had the aesthetic that you're going to keep pushing yourself. You always want to do something new. So if you're looking for something to regurgitate itself in your career, it's not going to happen, basically.
The large-scale work of my guest Julia Wolf, which was a runner-up for the Pulitzer Prize before she won it with Anthracite Fields, a work called Steel Hammer was inspired by the composer's love of the legend and music of Appalachia and the over 200 versions of the tale of John Henry. We'll hear the final minutes from the movement titled Characteristics. The Bang on the Can All-Stars perform along with the vocal ensemble Trio Medieval.
Here with what might be coming. One little point on Anthracite Fields, and a number of your pieces are like this. There can be, whatever they're based on, whatever the inspiration is, there can be a little bit of a social statement there on many different things. It could be on politics, it could be on gender, it could be whatever. This is not a manifesto, this piece, in any way. However, I don't think when you wrote it, and then subsequently you could have seen how, just to take an example, something like coal could come back into the political discussion. And here you are writing a piece that seems very relevant. Just a thought about that as a composer, when you write something which you don't mean as a political statement as such. There's obviously statements in there that people need to heed. But then it comes into the discourse.
That is very strange and surreal. And I wouldn't have thought that this piece would have been so directly in the dialogue, partly because the region I was looking at, Pennsylvania, coal mining was basically over by 1960s, maybe into 1970, but coal isn't over in the country. I mean, a good part of our electricity today is still coal-powered, and obviously there's this debate, should coal come back? To me, it's like, why would you want coal to come back? It was very interesting because I was wondering what the politics were of everyone living in Scranton, and as it turns out, when Barbara Powell, who's the person who grew up in the patch town, when she was interviewed, she's like, we don't want our men going back down into the coal mines. I mean, she lived it, and she saw it was really come up with something new, you know, because let's have something. It's just like the modern age, all this incredible intelligence and energy and time put into, like, my iPhone. Let's just figure out, like, how to use energy and not go back to a situation that really was terrible for the people working there. I mean, everybody got black lung. And there are cave-ins, and they haven't perfected that. There's still incredible dangers to that business. Plus, it's all going to be mined out. I mean, the Pennsylvania region is mined out. West Virginia, yes, there's still coal, but it's like there are better ways to give people jobs. That's a real issue, that people need jobs. But there are more forward-looking ways to employ people. And so these are things I really care about deeply and think about. And the fact that it's now in conversation, somehow the coal miners are in the photographs, you know, with the president, to me is somewhat painful because I don't see the current administration thinking a lot about the voice of people working. Yes, you can say, oh yeah, we want to create more jobs. But what about collective bargaining? You know, what about these issues of a group of people who are working having some say about their lives? Mm. That's really important dialogue. Those guys worked so hard for. The fights were so deadly and intense. They were beaten up for striking, and they were striking for real reasons. And thank goodness the conditions are much better today. But there was no limit on how long the work week was. There were no safety secure things put into place. All these laws were enacted, and everything came out of people dying and striking. And how currently there's just a lot less interest in that. I'm not saying there aren't unions. Obviously, some of the unions are very strong and powerful, but less and less. And you really see these examples of coal towns where there's like no company that has a union in place. And you're like, how could that possibly be? If you see the movie Harlan County, USA, it's just like, these people died for this reason. I'm like, they're rolling over in their grave. So that's very interesting dialogue, but very disturbing dialogue at the same time. And so it's something I care a lot about. And I kind of baffled that it's even in public dialogue in a certain sense. But there it is. And so I think it has this resonance that's different than when I first wrote it, which was just a few years ago.
You talk about a use for robots. If people want to mine coal, develop robots can go in and do it.
Yeah, and actually that also, it is automated now. So yeah. There aren't even that many jobs anyway. So that they've been writing about that, you know, the press.
And Scranton is a Joe Biden country, so.
Yes, yes. Scranton is a very interesting city.
So final thing, talking about things of social issue. I mean, what are you working on would be the question, but are you still doing this piece about women working in factories in New York? And can you give us any information about that?
Yeah, miles to go before I rest, but it's been great. I've been reading, mostly just reading. I haven't done like so much traveling and interviewing. And the thing about that industry is, unlike coal mining, that the world I'm looking at is over. I mean, there are still garment industries. There are still a lot of problems in the garment industry. I probably will take a look at some of the current situations in Chinatown, for example, and certainly overseas. There are still fires in garment factories that shouldn't be. So I will look at some contemporary issues as well. But for now, the main resources I have are archives and books and newspapers, actually. It's great to read old newspaper articles about the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire, and the photographs are so powerful. Unfortunately, no recording at that time, so I can't capture sound, very little moving image. And so it's mostly in retrospect, although some great interviews with some of the women who were real leaders in the union. But they were like interviews conducted in the 1960s. So like you'll have like Clara Lemlich, who was an unbelievable figure, 19 years old. She's like telling everybody they have to go out and leave the workplace and go to the streets. So they're talking to her and she's looking back at what that time period was like. But that's also helpful and really great.
This is still slated for 2018?
I believe so. I have to check in on this. I mean, it's a very nice process for me, actually, because I'm workshopping the piece in chunks at universities with university orchestras, and then eventually it'll be for the New York Philharmonic and Women's Choir. And it looks like fall 2018. It's in the 2018-19 season.
That's the biggest thing you're working on.
Yeah, I'm working on a couple of different things, but that's definitely the large project, and again, like another labor history subject that's close to my heart. And there are a lot of, again, very personal connections. The Triangle Shirtwaist Building is an NYU building, and it's literally a block from where I teach. So okay. I walk by it all the time. Just also being a New Yorker. All these other pieces were pretty guy-heavy. I realized, why am I writing about these guys working? Each piece, you know, that I've written in the past, like Anthracite Fields and Steel Hammer, have very important threads. It's important for me about women in that conversation, but the workers were guys. And so I thought, wait a minute, like, I got to look at some women. And so the garment workers were, there were certainly plenty of men working in the garment industry as well, but like the uprising of 20,000, predominantly women. And young women, like they're like 19, 20 years old. And so very exciting to me.
Well, you can hear one of her guy working pieces tomorrow night the night after with Westminster Choir doing Anthracite Fields. I close all my cadenza interviews by asking my guests the same two quick questions. The first is a hypothetical, which simply says if you could chat with someone like we've been chatting from the past, someone you never had a chance to but could. What's the first name that pops into your head when I said that? If you think about it, you get swamped, but...
Oh, I know. Well, I guess Beethoven did come up. But, you know, he's apparently a really difficult guy. So I don't know how much fun that would be. But that's just the first name that came to mind because the kind of power of music and the innovation.
Yeah.
But I would have loved to have talked to Pete Seeger as well. I mean, just that was such an incredible life. So Okay. I did actually get to talk to Jean Ritchie for a few minutes on the phone. I called her once because I wanted to buy a dulcimer, and I can't believe she answered the phone. Actually, she did. And she's like, well, I don't really have any dulcimers, but here's where you can call. And that's the extent of that conversation. But
it would have been so wrong for those folkies to have a press agent. I mean, as in-between person.
I guess
it would just been against the whole
thing. Yeah, it was amazing that she...
You could have called Pete Seeger. He probably would have picked up the phone.
I probably missed my chance. Yeah, right. I know.
Final question is a non-musical question. Everybody I interview in Cadenza fills their life with music. You're extremely busy with the composing here, teaching at Drew and NYU. When you have to get yourself away from music, respite, pleasure, relaxation, enjoyment, but can get away, what do that can take yourself away?
When do I get away? I'm actually not the best at taking
breaks. It's not a when question. It's what.
What would I do? Okay. Well, there are different answers for that. I mean, I really like, well, I'd love to go to the ocean. I don't do that enough. Like, so I can say that's what I would like to do.
Yeah.
But I'm a real family person. I spend a lot of time with my family, and I have two kids. And so a good part of my life is in that context. So it's to me, it's a balance that I really love. It's not an easy balance because you're juggling things. But in terms of like pure fun, I really like hiking. So I'd say just going on a hike. I do a lot of hiking in the summer because we do this program, Bang and a Can Summer Institute, up at Massmoka, and that's in the Berkshires. So take my dog, and he's off-leash, which is incredible for a city dog, and just go walking. I'd say walking, and particularly hiking.
We need to do those hikes on the ocean.
It'll get it all together, yes. Get the two things together. Move to Los Angeles.
Thanks for taking some time.
Thank you.
Composer Julia Wolf. You can find out more about her at her website, Julia Wolf, that's Wolf with an E, juliawolfmusic.com. We look forward to her large-scale work with the New York Philharmonic about women working in the garment industry inspired by the horrific 1911 Triangle Shirtwaist Company factory fire that killed 145 workers. Her Pulitzer Prize-winning work, Anthracite Fields, will be performed tomorrow night and Saturday night at 8 by the Westminster Choir and Bang on a Can All-Stars, all conducted by Joe Miller. The performances will be in the monumental space of the Roebling Wireworks, located at 675 South Clinton Avenue in Trenton. It'll be semi-staged by Doug Verone and utilizing video projections. This docu-oratorio about the mining industry draws connections to Trenton, as the coal from those mines played a vital role in Trenton's industrial success, inspiring the slogan, Trenton makes the world takes. Tickets available at 609-921-2663 or online at writer.edu/anthracite_fields. I'll leave you with a few more minutes from the recording of that work featuring the Choir of Trinity Wall Street, the Bang on the Can All-Stars, all conducted by Julian Wachner, the last minutes of the hour-long piece, the final moments from the final movement titled Appliances. Music by my guest today, Julia Wolf. And as always, I'm glad you're in the audience today, and I hope you'll join me here each week for a chat with the great classical musicians of our area and the globe. Remember, you can catch any recent past Cadenza program by going to wwfm.org and clicking on Classical and then Webcasts. I ask you to please support this and the many specialty programs we offer by making your donation today at our website. Thank you, and thanks for listening. I'm David Ozenberg, and this has been the award-winning Cadenza, an exclusive production of the Classical Network at WWFM.org.
Know about you.